Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle. Well, hello. I hope you are having a wonderful summer so far. This is the first of the Rewind episodes. I am really happy to replay this one. This is episode 11. It was done back in March of 2017. I cannot believe how long ago that was. Beth Bedell is sharing her story around end-of-life issues and advanced health care directives. I wanted to share this one for a couple of reasons. One, this is one of our most popular episodes. Two, this is a topic that comes up for people right now, right? People are thinking about this a little differently with COVID, and it's just kind of in our face. If you know somebody who has died or nearly died of COVID, these are things many of us are thinking about, and how do we want that to look, and what do we want? And even though we're kind of thinking about it, I honestly don't think that we're talking about it enough, and maybe even feeling that sort of out of control aspect of things. But that's part of why I want to have this conversation and replay this one and keep having the conversation in various ways so that we can maybe make some positive changes and feel more confident and less fearful of what end-of-life situations might look like. If this is a topic that interests you, I also want to mention that as of maybe a year or so ago, Sarah Seidelman and I started hosting some death cafes. And if you're not familiar, I highly suggest you check out the concept of death cafe, but I want to direct you to our Facebook page, which is called Death Cafe of the North. Feel free to join it for the articles. It's also where we post when we actually have death cafes, which is something that we do not do regularly, but we put it out there when we end up making it happen. And so they've been in person, of course, until COVID, in which case we did have a virtual one. So that was amazing. We get to have people from other states with us. So check that out. For now, I'm going to send you right into this episode and this conversation with Beth. I re-listened to most of this and really enjoyed it in the conversation and the thought processes that it brings up. So I hope that you do too. Before we head into Beth's episode, I want to say thank you to all of you for listening. And of course, all of you who have supported the podcast, whether you're sharing the information with people you think might be interested, or especially those of you who are part of the Patreon community, the Wellness Renaissance Patreon community. Thank you for your continued support. It is really wonderful to know that the work that I do and the mission that I'm on is of value. So thank you so much for that. Thank you to Green Home Solutions for your continued support as an advertising member. If you're not familiar with Green Home Solutions, they are somebody that is not only here in Duluth, Minnesota, but all over the United States. And you can find out about them at greenhomesolutions.com. They are the indoor air quality experts dealing with mold remediation, odor, and allergen control. Keep them in mind if you've got something going on in your home, in your office, at your cabin. I really appreciate that they have a mind on sustainability and our planet. And I just wanted to read you a paragraph from their website because I think this is an important piece. It says, our indoor air quality services don't just cover up odors, mold, smoke, or other toxins. We remediate with treatments that denature bacteria, fungi, and other toxic substances for cleaner air. That can be an important thing in your own house, or if you're buying a new house, or whatever the case might be, if you're having some effects from the thing that you are smelling, inhaling, that might be bothering you. So check out greenhomesolutions.com, and that website will get you to the nearest location to you. And if you're in Duluth, 218-206-9549 will get you to Steve. All right, let's head on in with Beth. I'm really excited to reshare this conversation with you. It's a really good one. Hey there, this is Judy Brewer. Thank you so much for listening. I want to dive pretty quickly into the interview, but I do want to give you a short intro before the intro within the interview before we head into that. I'm sharing with you today a really fantastic conversation that I had with Beth Bedell. Beth is from the Twin Cities, and I think she has a pretty important story to share and a message that she is definitely wanting to pass along. The topic is advanced healthcare directives, and I totally know that this sounds like an quote-unquote old people conversation, but it really isn't. It really is important for all of us, and I think that's why listening to this is just really something that everybody can take value from for yourself, for your family members, whatever. You'll understand why she's such an advocate for having an advanced healthcare directive in the first place, and how she is working to figure out how to support creating an environment in the medical system where we can be confident advanced healthcare directives, as well as other things that we have in place, will be findable, utilized, and our wishes will be followed in a medical situation. And if you're thinking, hey, I've got a medical directive, no big deal, I'm good to go, there are definitely some things within that you might find valuable to know as well.
I have Beth Bedell with me today, and we are going to talk about, especially Beth is going to talk about, healthcare directives, the systems and organizations that are in place to help us do that, and in some case, maybe not as helpful to help us do that as we would like. This has been a topic for me that has been of interest for a really long time, and I'm not really sure why, but to be able to see people have the most comfortable end of life experience in general. Maybe it's because I don't like pain and discomfort, but I've always just seen this as something really important and have taken advantage of whatever opportunities I could to learn about it. When I was in college, I really began to have an understanding of how, in a sense, taboo this topic is and how many people don't want to talk about it, young or old. I did a couple projects and learned how many people really didn't want to talk about it. And that concerned me deeply because I had heard conversations of people who would put up a funeral for a member of their family. And they were like, we don't really know if we have what they wanted. We did what we kind of wanted, but we'd love to have known that we did what they wanted too. So it's a big topic. It's a really important topic. Beth, let's start with your experience and why this is so important to you.
Thanks, Judy. Well, first of all, I want to make sure people understand I am not a healthcare provider. My background has primarily been in agricultural communications and administration. I came by this as a patient. Several years ago, I was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor that damaged the nerves on my face, which causes considerable pain. And at that time, I put together a healthcare directive stating that I did not want to be resuscitated. Then a couple years later, I went into the hospital with chest pains, and the doctor assured me I was not having a heart attack, that the tests were all coming back and everything looked really good, and that many things can mimic a heart attack. And as he was telling me this, I went into cardiac arrest. And although I had a healthcare directive that said do not resuscitate, I was resuscitated anyway. And so then I found out about Pulse, the provider's orders for life-sustaining treatment, mm-hmm. and had one. This is something that a physician or a healthcare provider signs and puts into your medical record. And I had that put into my medical record. And then more recently, I went into the hospital again with chest pains, and I told the emergency room people that I had a Pulse on file and an advanced care directive, and to please pull them up to make sure that they could see it. And they were unable to pull it up. They
wow.
could not. And yeah, so which made me very, very uneasy. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in what's going on. As a result of all this, there was a story about me in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And as a result of that, my healthcare service started working on their records. But even still, I mean, this is a national problem. It's not my
right.
health system. This is like something like 40% of physicians do not feel that they are able to find, they say that knowing that there's an advanced care directive or Pulse on file is very, very important, but about half state that they are uncertain on how to find it in the records. And that's scary.
That's really concerning. And I'm thinking about when my mother-in-law was in the hospital, I think we had it in our hands most of the time.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm not, and even now, I've been told that they've done a lot to change it. I'll backtrack a little bit. When I go to my dentist's office, I gave them a copy of the pulse because they have an automatic defibrillator in the office. And so I gave them the pulse and said, you know, put this in your file so that you know that I do not want to be resuscitated should something happen in the dentist chair. Mm-hmm. And so whenever he pulls up my records, there's a big red thing that comes across the screen that says DNR, and it's there for about 2 or 3 seconds, and then it goes away, and then he can see what, you know, what else he needs to see there. And, you know, like as the computer goes to sleep and he punches it back in, it comes, that DNR comes up again. And I was hoping that that was what, you know, the healthcare system would do, but I was told that that would be unlikely. And now more recently, I've been told that there's a banner that comes up, and I'm going, so is that immediately, or does that, don't you have to click to get there? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, it's a banner. And I go, so a yes or no answer. And we're clearly not quite communicating well. I was also in a hospital another time more recently. It's like, I'm not sure which one this is going on with, but the most recent time I was in the hospital, I asked them to pull it up. And I said, so if I went into cardiac arrest, you know, and she still had to click to get there. And this was before I had talked to these other people about, you know, the banner and stuff. But anyway, she said that, well, yes, of course we would if we know it's there. And I said, how would you know it's there if you didn't look for it? Mm-hmm. And she couldn't answer my question. So
that's a big gap.
Yeah, and you know, like really with cardiac arrest, you only have a few minutes to do something. And so, and like, I get it. The physicians are like, I am trained to save lives. They're going to go save the life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like, oh, let me just go wander around the healthcare. You know, that isn't going to happen.
Right. You're right. It needs to be right there in some way that is just so clear for people. Because, and I want to come back to a couple things that you've said. One of them being, it's interesting and great that the newspaper article sparked some movement forward. And, sure. And just goes to show how important it is to create that sort of awareness that's out in the world a little bit. Didn't solve the problem completely, but it's at least a step forward. And I'm also, the one question that I want to ask, because I'm thinking this might be coming up in some people's minds, is, so you were resuscitated and
yeah.
You are fine, right? Or it, so why might, like, tell me some of the challenges and why you might not want to be resuscitated.
The thing people need to understand about cardiac arrest is that, you know, like on doctor shows, they go boom with the paddles and the patient comes back to life, or, oh dear, we lost the patient.
Right.
It's, but the general thought is from watching the shows is that usually the resuscitation works. It only works about 20% of the time.
Wow. Brings
people back to life. You know, it's and then about half the time people end up like Terry Schiavo. Mm-hmm. You know, of the 20%, percentages vary depending on which study you look at, but a goodly number of that 20% end up not doing so well.
Right.
And so I really would prefer to be let go to allow for a natural death rather than end up in a situation that I do not want to find myself. And also, I think I am doing fine and everything is really good. But I looked, when I got out of the hospital, I looked up information about cardiac arrest and found that, statistically speaking, I have a 5% chance of survival after 3 years, which that ends in June.
Wow.
I suspect that I will beat the odds once again.
Have to have yourself a re-birthday party.
But what was troubling about that is, you know, the lack of comfort doctors and clinical people have about talking about healthcare directives and end-of-life wishes and this kind of thing is also a problem. When I went to my cardiologist and asked, you know, I saw this study. It looks like I have, you know, like probably only 3 years to live. What? And she said, well, I don't like to talk about that. And but
I don't like to hear, from the patient's perspective, I don't really like to hear that I should quit eating sugar because I've got diabetes either, but we kind of got to talk about it.
So, there's training, there's comfort level, there's, so many things involved that I am being kind of a thorn in the clinic side because I'm, so why aren't we doing this? Doctors, they're human, they're people.
Right.
And it's difficult for them too, but they should be trained to know how to handle it. And right now there is almost no training. Honoring Choices does provide some training at the medical school at the U of M, but it's only a couple of hours worth on the whole topic of healthcare directives and posts and that kind of thing. So,
and it's probably more specific on here's what it is versus here's how we talk about this really big issue that every single person goes through in their life, and it's a really can be a very big and time consuming thing. And to, like you were saying earlier, the job of these people is to save lives.
Right.
And so that's the direction they go. And so that's where they're geared. And I know I've heard doctors say that, but I've also heard, doctors who've kind of come to the reality that this is a real thing, that they have to learn how to deal with this. They have to learn to be comfortable with it because they are the resource for the person. And this is a part of life. And you can't just sort of drop the ball at that point because it's uncomfortable. And they are the people we look to as knowing how to do this. And I know I was really surprised to learn that that wasn't a discussion. I know I talked to somebody who goes to being educated by our medical school. And we have, in my degree, we had a death education class. And we had a couple other classes that dealt with, that really kind of dove into death a little bit. And the death education class was very broad. So you were talking about different cultures. We toured a funeral home. We toured...
crematorium?
Yes, the crematorium. And various things, and just having these discussions, it was a really great thing for all of us. It was really an educational class. And I know that there was discussion about we need to get medical students in here. And I'm thinking, it blows my mind that this isn't a mandatory class.
Right.
For medical students. And that was just a really big eye opener. This is when people sometimes really need your doctor in knowledge and compassion the most. And to not have that resource, it helps understand why we're all not talking about it well. And I know, kind of back to the whole everybody wants everybody to live, which is a great thing, but that's not always what the person wants to experience if something really bad does happen to them.
Right. Well, it's, people saying, like, oh, well, it's better than the alternative, meaning death. And I'm going, not always. there are times when, people are so sick and in so much pain.
Right.
The other thing that scares me is, we just give them morphine and everything is fine. They're relaxed, they're pain free. When I had surgery many years ago, I was given a morphine drip thing where I could press the little button to give myself more morphine.
Oh yeah.
And I wouldn't do it because it would give me these horrible hallucinations.
Oh.
I thought I had rabies. I thought I was being experimented on by aliens. It was
wow, that's intense.
Yeah, and so that's not how I want to end my days.
Right.
Having just a nightmare. That scares me. What are they going to do to treat my pain? And
right.
That there really aren't a whole lot of things there that we can find. So
right, that's an interesting thing from my personal perspective. Me and morphine and I do not get along. It just makes me ridiculously sick, and I don't respond to pain pills pretty much at all.
Same here.
I was in a spiritually based class, and one of the things we did, we wrote our own death scene and funeral.
Yep.
And I think everybody should do that. I think it really puts you in contact with what does that all mean and what do you want. And you're not necessarily thinking about the alternative of how bad it could be, but I think it focuses you in on the how great it could be. And
yeah.
There's a lot we can control, but there's more that we can than I think we realize. Or just like you're saying, if you've got a plan and that plan isn't respected or followed because it couldn't be found, you're the one who has to live with that consequence.
Right. Yep. And, don't get me wrong, I'm very, very, very happy to be here. It's not like I'm you know, wanting to die right now or anything. That isn't the point, but it's making sure that my wishes are honored. And on one level, I kind of feel like when they resuscitated me, I was deprived of a very easy death. You know, it's like, oh, because going into cardiac arrest, there's a little chest pain, but it's kind of like fainting.
Okay.
And so it's like, well, that's it. You know, so it's kind of an odd feeling to have, but there's a little bit of me that says, well, dang. Go through the whole deal, and you know, and I'm already dealing with trigeminal nerve pain with my face, and I've got some peripheral neuropathy in my legs. There's a Facebook thing, and you know, like according to doctors, these are the 10 worst pains. I got 2 of them.
Oh, interesting! Oh. Wow.
I, you know, on one level, I'm very, very grateful to be here, but there's this other like, well, but I should have died, you know, and it's interesting to me for Christians or whatever who, you know, like life is hard, but when I get to heaven, it will all be wonderful, that they aren't really wanting to go to heaven or understand, you know, and now it's, I guess I don't understand that it seems like there's this chasm there where, you know, yes, this is, life is hard. We, you know, we toil, we work, we, you know, do all this stuff. And when I get to heaven, there it'll be, but, you know, the wonderful life I'm looking forward to, and yet everybody's so afraid to go.
Yes, yes. No, I exactly have seen that and hear that. It's like, well, wait a minute, why, you know, but I'm sure it's the unknown, but it's always baffled me as well. When somebody says, no, I don't want Herculean efforts to be made. Well, but why? And sometimes it's the selfishness, you know, legitimate selfishness, but I want you around. And which is very nice and wonderful. But if you are living a life where you are not able to function and somebody maybe has to take care of you all the time, you're not really living a life. And granted, it's a lot of unknowns, but that can be a long time to live in a very uncomfortable position where you may not be able to advocate for yourself. You know, you hear the stories where somebody gets put on life support, that decision was made, and then you can't unmake decisions like that sometimes. I don't even remember how all that legalistic stuff works, but I've certainly heard of families who have members of their family who have been on life support type things for a long time because they say, we made a decision, we can't unmake it. And that's a scary thing to me. Yeah. And my goodness, if that person is in there, what must their life be like when they spend most of it alone?
Yes. Friends and family will come visit for initially a lot. And then after a certain amount of time, they just don't show up anymore.
Right.
Are alone. You know, one of the things that I was told with the pulse is, you know, well, we have to keep asking people if, you know, if these are their wishes. After I got out of the hospital at one time, I was talking to the emergency room director because I wrote a letter of complaint. This is when they couldn't find my records. And I said, so if I came into the hospital now and you pulled up my records and I went into cardiac arrest, what would happen? And the doctor said, well, you need to understand, doctors have what's called alert fatigue. There are so many alerts on those medical records that their eyes just glaze over and they don't even look at them anymore.
Oh, my goodness. And
then he ended the conversation with, well, I hope you're feeling more confident now to the emergency room. No, I think I need to get a tattoo on my chest. Kate?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, well, and that's a great idea. But then,
the tattoo is not a legal document, and because I could change my mind at any moment, and thinking, well, at what point? I mean, like, do you keep asking the patient, "Do we resuscitate you now? Should we resuscitate you now? Should we?"
Right.
At what point do I get to say no and have it stick?
Well. And isn't many times when they kind of need to ask that question if you're already down?
Right. They're not. There's no way to do it. And I said,
right.
I've already gone into cardiac arrest. You know, there is no talking to me about it. I'm there. You know, what would happen?
Right.
Well,
right.
Yeah, their eyes just glaze over.
Wow. And so I'm thinking, is there a fear of, like, say, a family member suing them?
That's probably a part of it. Oh, I can't think of his name. There's an amazing video by ZDoggMD, ZDoggMD, and you can find it on YouTube. and it's called Ain't No Way to Die. He talks about the very thing that you were saying about being sued. He's saying there's, you know, like, whatever relative in wherever, you aren't even in the state. What do you, you know, and like, who doesn't even know, but they want to say, wait a minute, don't pull the plug. I think he'll wake. And it's like, you ain't even in the state.
Right.
And so there probably is a little bit of that. There's also, doctors don't like to have patients die on them, you know, not
right.
so much. You know, it's hard for them. It's very difficult for them to have a patient die on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I understand all the conflicts and stuff, but how do we go forward? And
right.
I'm not sure. You know,
well, and it seems to me we need to somehow have these conversations and have the trainings with the doctors and the doctors to be a little bit more, hey, we need to talk about this so that you get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to live the best life you can live. Yeah, so doctors can be comfortable. Because to me, I'm like, look, if somebody had a DNR and they went on your watch, you did your job.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. And you honored them and their wishes. You know, and I certainly know when I was talking to a nurse with my mother-in-law in the hospital, and she was basically just saying, yeah, well we don't want them to die here. It looks bad for our stats.
Well,
you know, so we want to get them out of the hospital and get them to hospice or wherever we can because it's not great for our statistics. And I bristle at the statistic piece. Like, statistics are important, but sometimes things happen. And
yeah.
And, you know, if you're keeping me alive because you don't want me to die in your building, then you need to provide me with the best care for the rest of my life.
And you're And
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Part of living life is being able to partake in it. And if I'm stuck in a room where nobody's visiting me for 2 years, that is severe boredom.
So if I, you know, I need to have a sense of humor, I need to be able to sing, and I need to be able to talk to people coherently.
Right.
If I'm not moving toward that goal, then no, you know, these are the things that are really important to me.
Right. And that's the key. That's so much of a key question is what is living to you? And talk about the book.
Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal?
Yes.
Okay, that's an excellent book. I'd also like to talk a little bit about Katie Butler's book, Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Perfect.
Which, okay, so Atul Gawande's book, it's written by a doctor on the East Coast, and he talks about how modern medicine has done a terrific job of extending lives. We have all these amazing tools at our disposal, and we can keep going. But, you know, there comes a point where it may not be the best thing, and it's time to start looking at what is the quality of life. How can we make life at the very end be the best, each day be the best day possible for the person? You know, and nursing homes are so concerned about patient safety, but they don't really look at the patient's happiness so much. You know, like there's something about how younger people, for their elders, they want them to be safe. They want them to be in a place where they're safe and they're taken care of and they're safe. But what everybody wants is autonomy for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you do not get that in a nursing home or, you know, even in an assisted living place many times. There, you know, slow down. Don't go so fast. Don't, you know, we take care of everything. All you have to do is come for lunch or, you know, whatever. And then towards the end of the book, he's talking about, in Atul Gawande's book, he's talking about, he grew up in the United States, but he's from India and his father was from India. And how life is, you know, he's been back to India many times and to the village where his parents are from and how his grandfather, their whole, you know, he's within the whole family thing. The family takes care of, the whole community takes care of the person and they're allowed to continue on doing what they would do. And he was talking about his grandfather who had a farm and every day he would go out and inspect the field, you know, on horseback. And even up until his dying days, they took him out in, you know, on horseback, and you would never get that in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it's like, oh no, you wouldn't be safe doing that. You can't do that. But what's happening now too is they're realizing that seniors in many of these institutions, because they are so restricted that they aren't getting enough movement, they're losing muscle. They're
sure.
You know, they're becoming weaker because they're in the institution. Rather than being safe, they're actually declining faster than if, you know, so it's hard to know where, how to handle this. It's an ongoing thing. And then, you know, nursing homes are starting to change, you know, more the assisted living, but they're, you know, like having art classes and music and things like that in there. Whereas before it used to be, you just sort of sit there and hope somebody would come visit you, but things are changing but it takes time.
And it's not, it's, as much as those are great things, it's also not real life.
Right.
You know, it's not getting out into your field, the things that you have built your whole life that is meaningful every day, that drives your desire for existence.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, I highly recommend that book. And then another one is Katie Butler's book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. And Katie Butler is a journalist, and she talks about her parents' decline and her own anxiety about everything that's happening. And she lives in California, on the West Coast, I think California, and then her parents live on the East Coast. So, you know, there's this long distance care, trying to make sure everything's taken care of. She gets advice and then finds out that it's totally worthless. And it, within all that, she weaves the whole what Medicare pays for and, you know, how it's affecting the family and the family dynamics. And it's an excellent book as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
and I haven't read that one. I have read Being Mortal.
Okay.
It's one of those things where I wish so many people could read it, because I think it really does bring out some great, not only great questions to have with your family members of finding out what they want, but ways for you to think about it too. And I think it's allowing that conversation. I have a friend who's a pastor. He's a retired pastor, but he would go around to hospices and visit people. And he had one guy one day, I remember the story, where he was saying the guy was so happy to talk to the pastor, because he says, my family won't let me talk about death. Like, I'll talk about it, and they're like, oh, you're going to be fine, or, you know, kind of dismissing it. And he's like, I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
I'm dying. I'm in hospice. We need to talk about this. And so he was so appreciative of my friend being able to just have that conversation.
Yep. Yeah. I had the same thing happen with me. I got out of the hospital at one of the times, I can't remember which one, probably after my heart attack. I sent a letter and a copy of my healthcare directive and a copy of Atul Gawande's book to all my siblings and several of my nieces and nephews. And the response I got back from people was pretty amazing. My one brother, who is in his late 70s, couldn't read the book. It was just too disturbing. It was, I don't know what you're thinking. And he finds my thoughts about having a pulse just totally, he can't understand it. His daughter was kind of grateful that I sent this out, because it's, you know, she was hoping it would give her a chance to open up the conversation with her father, you know, about what do you want? I don't know what you want.
Right.
And as a result, they've kind of started talking and getting things figured out. And then one of my nieces said, this is the strangest letter I have ever received. I can't imagine why you would have sent it. and then another niece said, thank you so much. This is, you know, I agree with everything you're saying right here. I fully understand. So, you know, they may not agree with me, but at least they know what my thoughts are.
And they may agree over time.
Yeah. But I get teased, you know, from you know, my brother. Yeah, they just keep telling him, you know, this is what real life is about. And you're very fortunate you haven't had any major catastrophic things happen to you, but this is what it looks like. And I think he is starting to be more aware of why I'm thinking this, because another brother has had some major health issues as well. So, you know, I think my oldest brother is kind of, it's seeping in a little bit. But it's a start. It's a
right
start.
And I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to take those little bit of steps, and then you see something happen and you process that differently.
Right.
I think your example is great of the whole, in the book, living in India, you have this sort of process for dying. It takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a village to help somebody die. And they have this process, and it is about kind of living your fullest life. And then we here in America have the best medical care, which means keep them alive at all costs.
Right.
And then we don't have to examine when you can do, if you want to look at sort of the God's plan thing, we're interfering potentially with God's plan by putting in all of these human interventions, which may be a wonderful thing for so many people and for situations. And then for other people,
it's a scary thing, and it's taking things too far and talking about a natural death. Well, technically, that's not a natural death. If we didn't have the interventions we have, you wouldn't be here.
Right.
You know, which, again, sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it's not. But because we have such amazing medical care and things we can do, and we're learning so much, we have to think about that as a not just a yay, we can do it, but should we do it, and when is it appropriate?
Right. Just because we can do something doesn't mean that we have to or that we should.
Right. And I also am thinking about this while you're talking, is how when we put animals down,
right,
we say, oh my gosh, if they could only tell us what they wanted, if they only could tell us when we're ready, they're ready. And, you know, many of us who are really connected with our animals, we kind of think we know, you know, and we do the best we can, but we still would like them to just go, okay, now let's go, let's get out of here, you know, let's go to the vet. We have words and language and communication, and we need to utilize that to honor ourselves and to honor our relatives. And, you know, and so we don't have the somebody coming in and panicking and saying, no, you can't let mom die when mom really does want to die. And to have the conversation, I love that you're doing that. I think that's such a beautiful example. I love that you're taking advantage of this time that you are given to really advocate for yourself and for so many other people who may not even know they need advocating for because they haven't had the experience yet.
Yeah.
But to have that conversation with so many people so there isn't the one person, or if there is one person who says, no, there's five other people who could say, no, this is what she said she wanted. We should honor this.
Part of my exploration was to go take the advanced care planning facilitator class at Honoring Choices.
Yes.
That it's a program where you take a bunch of classes online learning about advanced care planning and everything, and then you go in for a day and you practice having conversations with people in your class. You know, like you break up into little groups of three or four and take turns, you know, like eliciting responses, and because you can't put in your own biases or say, you know, like everybody should want to have a pulse, you know, do not resuscitate. You know, you have to ask, what does that mean? How does that work for you? You know, when Uncle Joe died, you said it was a terrible thing. Tell me about that. And how did that affect you? And so learning how to go about doing advanced care planning and talking about it has been very, very helpful for me. I've been so belligerent about having a DNR on file because I felt like I wasn't being heard. The ball was dropped several times within my medical clinics and the hospital, and then, you know, my brother kind of giving me a hard time about what I want and other people giving me advice, well, you really shouldn't want that. And I was just getting, you know, like this bull in a china shop. You know, and, you know, which doesn't help anything, that it's just confrontational, and it can't be that. And so I took this class, and it's been very helpful to me as far as, you know, just being able to express myself a little better. And now I'm sort of thinking about volunteering to be a facilitator. I'm not sure I would be, you know, terrific at it, but I think right now my clinic doesn't have anybody. It's very strange. And I am going to say the names of the clinic. It's Health Partners, which is also Park Nicollet. They came together, and Park Nicollet has classes. They have somebody who will help you with your advanced care, advanced directive. They do all these different things. Health Partners has none of that.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, well, why not? And so I'm just discovering this part of it. There are all these little avenues that I'm exploring, and so now I'm delving into this one. But I look on the websites for most of the major healthcare systems in the Twin Cities area, you know, Health East and Allina and things like that. And on all of them, within one click, you can find resources for advanced care planning. You go to the Health Partners website, and you really have to click around to find anything. And you click on classes, and it's stuff about quitting smoking, or, you know, it's like the things that only pertain to a very small portion of the population. But healthcare directives, you really have to dig around to find anything.
Wow.
And I thought, just amazing. So now this is what my major focus for the next couple months. I will start with my clinic because that's where I am. I intend to go to the next Health Partners annual meeting and raise that question because I don't understand this.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense to me at all.
Well, and it's, you know, it is an interesting thing if it is just so many working parts into place and fear of the whole, well, if we give people advanced character actors, then they might use them. And then if we can't find them in their system, then, you know, will we get sort of in trouble for not using them, which is kind of legit. if we need to figure out that there needs to be some pretty severe stuff in place to figure out, now, how do we make this real? And how do we get over the fatigue that you were saying that doctors have of seeing all of these warnings? This is really important for people's lives and their choices. And
right.
If we're going to talk about how people need to advocate for themselves and take care of their wellness and their health, that this is part of that.
Right.
This is just as important as doing the yearly checkups and all the things that they want us to do. The bigger and real picture needs to be looked at for everybody. So, yeah, getting in there and normalizing the conversation, you're probably doing exactly what needs to be done. And it's probably one conversation at a time, you know, perhaps, you know, honoring choices obviously exists for a reason.
Right.
So talk about a little bit who might take that class, that certification.
Well, when I took it, I was the only just regular person off the street taking it. Everybody else was some sort of medical practitioner or a social worker or a chaplain or that kind of thing. So, you know, they all had this clinical kind of experience and knew how to do all these different things. And I'm going, okay, I don't know. But by the end of the day, I felt very comfortable with what I was doing, you know, like talking, asking questions and leading the conversation about how to, you know, like what is important to you with your, as far as your health directive goes. Yeah, it's more the medical and social work people who are in the class. And I suspect that is pretty typical. They don't usually get just interested people. They do, but not, you know, I made up maybe 1% of the class.
And it would be an interesting thing if there was a way for the average everyday person to be empowered to do that, because I'm thinking when it's part of your job, which is great. I'm glad that they're sending people, and that's important, and chaplains and things like that. There's so much sense in that. That's beautiful. For social workers, a really wonderful tool for them to have to bridge some conversations and help people bridge through the next step. I absolutely think these should be there, but boy, it would be great to have people who are passionate like yourself, a kind of a how do you continue to do this or how do you utilize this to have this conversation in a bigger way. When somebody has the passion and desire to do this, and like you have such a great experience, I'm sure there would be people who would really value working with you because you have such a real world experience. And it's coming from the heart, you know? It's not just part of what you're doing, but it's kind of a mission for you.
I feel like this is why I was resuscitated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, this is why I am still alive, is because this word needs to get out, and I'm on a roll with it. And one thing I'm doing, too, is this is a pilot project kind of thing at my clinic. My specific clinic is the Health Partners Como Health Club, and it's a group of patients and healthcare providers who work to be more healthy. And, you know, we have yoga classes and walking groups and cooking classes and things like that. And I've led a couple of meetings on discussing Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, and Katie Butler's book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. And I also went on having difficult conversations. That was co-led with a hospice doctor. But I'm also looking at, in April, which is April 16th, is National Healthcare Decisions Day. The main things in life are death and taxes, and taxes are due April 15th, and National Healthcare Decisions Day is April 16th. And around the Twin Cities area, there are all sorts of workshops and things about advanced care planning and things like that. And I am hoping to do one on, there's a game called My Gift of Grace. It's you'd play it in a group, you know, like small groups, so we can have a little discussion in it. You pull up a question, and it's things like, if you were incapable of doing this yourself, who would you ask to help you to go to the bathroom? You know, and it's questions like that to get the conversation going. I need to put in a proposal and get it approved and everything, but I'm hoping to be able to do that, you know, in April during healthcare decisions.
Yeah.
And see, you know, if it turns out to be a success that we have, you know, like people think it's really important, then I would want to advocate for having like several of it. There's a whole card stack, you know, like I think there's, I can't remember how many cards there are, but you would not be able to get through all of them in an hour and a half. It would take several times. So, you know, like maybe having several sessions of that. But it's
right.
another thing to think about. There's also a card game called Go Wish. And what that is two decks of cards, and each card having something that is important to the person. I don't want to be in pain. I don't want to be connected to machines, things like that. And with this one, what you do is the person whose healthcare, the main player, puts down what they think, what is most important to them, and the other person puts down what they think is most important to player A, and to make sure that they line up. Because, you know, like, this would be the healthcare agent, and then see where the differences are and have a discussion about it. And I think this could be very helpful. What does it mean, you know, you don't want to do, you know, like, what does that look like in real life? One of the things was, well, you don't want to be intubated. What does that mean? And I said, I don't want a tube. And, well, what about a BiPAP? And I said, is that intubation? And they said, no. But apparently it's a machine that will make you breathe, but it's short of intubation. So I think I have that right. That's my understanding of it. And so, like, what does that mean? So it's trying to figure out what the nuances are so that there's a fuller understanding of what the person wants.
Right, because you, as you're creating these things or writing these things down or talking, you don't even necessarily know the right questions to ask yourself or
right.
What possibilities might be out there that, well, okay, they don't want that, but we'll do this. And it's like, no, I didn't want the result of that whole thing.
There's another book, too, that might be of help to people called Hard Choices for Loving People, by Hank Dunn. And what they do is go through different things like resuscitation. So it talks about what it is exactly, and then what are the pros of it, what are the cons of it. So you get a better understanding of what each of the different interventions is. And that might be helpful to just fully get a fuller idea of what you're talking about, because it's hard to know. We aren't medical people. We don't have that information.
Exactly. And you don't even know what the breadth of options are.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I remember in, I think it was 10th grade, my science teacher made us all write living wills.
Oh my gosh.
And it was in an ethics class. And I thought this was fantastic. Like,
yeah.
This is so interesting to me. And we had to take it home and have our parents sign it. And I actually found that very, I really appreciated that, because mine was very based around pain. You know, if I'm going to be in this huge amount of pain for the rest of my life or for whatever, I think I still have it in a box somewhere. But my dad sat down and read it and took it very seriously, which I really appreciated. And he kind of feels some of the same way. I mean, we talked a little bit about it from his perspective. And he has occasionally, when things have come up, made his ideas of, I don't want this to be done to me kind of thing. So it was a great opportunity to have that conversation with him. And to me, for me to be young, you know, I think this comes up from a lot of people too. When people are young, they just don't, you're not thinking about it, right? Like,
when you're young, you're immortal.
Right, exactly. And this whole conversation that we'd had in my ethics class really brought it to reality, because, you know, the reality is things can happen. You can get diseases, you can get hurt. And though we don't want to think about it, boy, it's helpful to go through some of that instead of kind of living in La La Land where you are immortal. I don't know how to lift the fear or push past that for people. I know one of my classes, the professor said when they meet the day they talk about death, she said half the class literally does not show up. So it's not even thinking that you're immortal. It's also a fear about talking about it.
Yeah. People are almost putting their fingers in their ears going, no, 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 no.
Exactly. And I get it. I don't really want to talk about it either, but boy, I tell you, to know that somebody is on my side in understanding what I would want if something horrible would happen.
Yes.
That's really a beautiful thing, too. We need to figure out how to keep having these conversations, and I think what you're doing is exactly it. And I wanted to bring up, I know you had mentioned talking about this, too, and I think it's a really important piece, is compassion and choices. That's an agency, right?
Right. As far as I know, I don't know that much about them, but my understanding is that they are trying to change the law to allow for doctor-assisted suicide or death with dignity, or however you want to phrase that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. It's palliative care doctors do not like this whole idea, because if that were put in place, they feel that it would diminish the capacity of doctors to do things that are actually helpful, that, you know, the palliative care doctors can make your life worth living. They can, for many people, they can make such a huge difference that people want to continue. Most people want to continue living. They will put off death. You know, the Oregon law with assisted suicide, they found that, you know, like, people just felt relieved that they would be allowed to be able to do that. It just, you know, makes it, it takes away the fear of being connected to a machine for the rest of your life. And so the fear from palliative care doctors is that the push towards more palliative care for patients would just be swept away in the whole tide of the death with dignity part of it. But on the other hand, doctors are not comfortable with, we have become so medicalized. Right. And doctors and medical people have such control over lives at the end, especially, that if it's going to be in a doctor's hands, then this tool should be given to them as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know. This is all I know about it. I haven't really looked into that too much because I haven't quite wanted to go there. And yet, with all of the things that I've been learning lately, it's something I may need to start exploring more.
From what I have done in research and talks that I have been in, I know one of the things that pops up is that it will be used against people who maybe have disabilities, or the family is sort of tired of having a person around, so they kind of convince them to do this.
Right. Yep.
And I totally think that's a legitimate fear. And I think that people should sort of have a right to also say, you know, no, I'm probably never going to say this and have that in their record. I'm probably never going to do this.
Right. Yes. Thing about, you know, I'm not dead yet. I'm, you know, like, don't discount me. Don't just write me off and kill me. And there is a big fear of that.
Right. And I think that's a legit fear. I don't think it's one that would necessarily be overused. But again, if it's used on you, it's kind of 100%. So that's a big deal. And I don't know if, I mean, how they can put things into place to make sure that that's okay. I can't remember the name of the woman who, the girl had an illness. And she wanted to take advantage of that because she knew she was...
to move to Washington?
Yes.
Yeah, Brittany something, I think.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the whole family picked up to support her in this. And I think, wow, what an amazing family. And I think the mom said in something I was watching, is she's like, look, we can do this because we have money. Not
right.
Everybody has this choice. We're able to do this. And I think what a great family to stand behind their daughter and make such a big move, and what a big example that is. But I think their point is also very valuable. You know, not everybody can just pick up and move to a different state to start the end of your life over. There's some legitimate fears, but I think it's also something we need to talk about too. I think for me, honestly, to know that that was an option would be a huge relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
once in a while, like, I ponder the thought of moving. I lived in Spokane for a few years, and Washington State has the death with dignity law. And part of me thinks, you know, would I want to move back to Washington State again? I'm not sure that I would. I mean, most of my siblings are here, most of my nieces and nephews, and, you know, my family's here. I've lived in a number of cities, and I keep coming back to Minnesota, and I think, well, I must need to live in Minnesota if I keep coming back here. But But then, you know, there's always that I don't feel confident in my medical care system as far as end-of-life treatment goes, and that's scary to me.
Right. And then the question arises, if you were in one of the other states, would you be able to utilize all of the things you're trying to put in place for yourself, and are there hoops to jump into? I think, like you're saying, you can put the right things into place, but if they can't be utilized or they're seen, that doesn't help.
Doesn't help, right. And, you know, and then there's part of me, like I said earlier, I think the reason I was kept alive is that I could fight for making these changes and doing what I can to go forward with that.
And you come from a place of experience, and I think one of the pieces that is so huge is the fact that you were resuscitated. So you have been through this and done that, where I know many people would be, oh, but I'd just be so relieved to be alive. And then that's a legitimate thought, but you're looking at it from a different perspective and a different reality. And I think that that's a voice that people might be able to listen to, or they might even walk away and go, wait a minute, that seems weird. But processing it for a little bit, it gives you a pretty solid respect for your perspective and point of view. And certainly there are other people who have lived through really traumatic things who have said, look, if I had it to do again, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
You know, I heard a story about a guy who was a horrible, horribly burned and was in a coma for many, many months, and was talking about the coming back from that, not only in the dealing with what had happened to his skin and his body, but then the muscular, the
yes.
getting back into living, into physically moving your body was torture. And, you know, he said that, no, I wish they wouldn't have kept me alive. And I remember the statement of, but you're here. And like, yeah, but you don't know what I had to go through to be here today, you know, kind of thing. And I think that that's also, that's an important thing to listen to.
Very much, yeah. It's just, it's a difficult topic, and more discussion needs to be had around it. And somehow we need to be able to normalize having that discussion, because people are just so uncomfortable that it doesn't get done. And
right.
I guess my goal is to try to find ways to normalize this kind of conversation.
Right. Where do you think is a conversational place to start for people? Like, if they want to, I mean, it's kind of dependent on the person you're talking to, but is there something key that people can think about, even if they're thinking about it in their own mind for themselves, or if they're thinking about it for a family member? Is there any way to open that door of discussion that can be kind of non-threatening?
Well, maybe taking it as, you know, like if you see something on the news, maybe, you know, like if the Terri Schiavo thing were just happening now, you know, or you see a news article or something about, you know, like something horrible happening to somebody, and just saying, you know, we're watching this, and I really don't know what you would want in this situation. Could we talk about it?
Mm-hmm.
What would you want to have done? Or, you know, like maybe if a relative or a loved one is in a bad accident or something, and the family is, you know, what do we do? I don't know what to do here. Well, you know, what happened to Uncle Joe? What do you think? What would you want done if that happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
And so taking it off the, you know, like coming up and saying, well, so do you want to be resuscitated or not?
Right.
That's not a real good conversation opener. Sideways a little bit. You can ease into it a little more. And even then, a lot of times there will be a lot of resistance because people don't want to talk about it. But you've maybe creaked open the door because you brought the topic up. And now suddenly, okay, the topic's been brought up. It's that little cat has, you know, opened the door. You
mm-hmm.
could not necessarily, don't press it, but, you know, come back maybe another day and say, you know, so come at it at a slightly different angle, and just sort of pushing it but not hammering on it, I guess, is the way to go for it. But, you know, come in sideways, not a direct confrontation kind of thing.
Okay, that's hopeful. And I know I was really impressed with the In Being Mortal. One of the questions that I remember him talking about was, what does it mean to live to you? And what do you, if you can't do X, it's
right.
not living. And I don't remember what comes from that book and what came from other things, but I know somewhere somebody's statement was, if I can't eat chocolate, like,
that's from that book.
Okay. And just, there were some really great examples, and I thought, you know, that really is an interesting way to think about it, because it really helps you frame it in a really life kind of way and a non-medical kind of way.
Yes.
It's a great conversation to have, because it's kind of, okay, well, but it, and then you can go from there, well, okay, but if you can't eat chocolate, but you can still do X and X, and then it like, helps you break that apart and go, okay, wait, maybe that's okay, or, you know, nope, sorry, it's the chocolate thing, you know? So I just, yeah, I'm excited that you found that book as kind of exciting as I did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm also working, I volunteered, I'm called a community teacher or something like that, and I have a couple of medical students and a pharmacy student. It's a interdisciplinary thing, and they've been interviewing me, and apparently they have to write a report on what my strengths are and where I'm going to need help and things like that. And then they hand it in because they need to do an interdisciplinary project, and I'm it. And so at the end of when we're done, I'm going to be giving them a copy of Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, and tell them, you know, this is an assignment, read this.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, you know, that'll spark a conversation or some thoughts or whatever. And it's just a few people, but I figure wherever I can do this, I probably purchased about 50 copies of that book and given it out to people.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I am really...
Got to start the conversation somewhere, and you never know where the ripples are going to go.
Right. So. Yes, exactly.
I just want to take a moment here to interject and create a quick transition and then pop us back into mid-conversation. Beth and I briefly considered the complexities regarding a few situations. So one of those situations is where they are looking for the DNR or healthcare directive. It takes up precious time that is needed to be doing life-saving procedures. Then there's the consideration of the person who has the DNR. It was not found quickly. So all measures then were taken to keep this person alive. They maybe are alive and okay, and things turn out pretty well. However, as Beth kind of mentions earlier, there may be some consequences that one doesn't really know about in varying degrees. Another scenario is that the directive isn't found. Life-saving procedures were taken and succeeded. The person may be alive, but not necessarily okay. So they may have some mild or maybe even very severe complication, impairment, etc. Something that they tried to alleviate having to live through and deal with by having put the tools in place that were not found. And that's where we dive back into the conversation.
Right. There aren't tools in place when the person, when they succeed at keeping you alive, but then you're faced with whatever consequences happen.
Right.
There's no, it's just like, well, that's the deal. That's what you get. Now deal with it. And that's it. And the reality is that can be hugely financial burdensome, and we don't want to make it about money.
Right.
It's a big piece of that. I mean, if you're the one who family members are taking care of and doing everything that they can to help and make you comfortable, but their life savings is going away because of it, that would be such a burdensome feeling, especially if you put all the tools into place and you do not resuscitate, whatever.
Right.
What do you do with that? And that's a really tough place for people to be, too.
And it's happening too often. Mm-hmm. It does seem to happen quite a bit. He would never want to live like that. He would never have wanted that. And yet, there he is. Yeah.
And then if you do something about it, it's a bad thing. You know, I mean, if a person says, you know what, I'm going to take my own life.
Right.
Because I can't. And that's horribly complex and painful and horrible. And oh, my goodness. I mean, wow. You know, to be able to feel that bad that you're willing to do that is a big deal. And then other people feel guilty, and because they're like, well, the only reason he did that was because we were paying for everything or whatever. It's a lot of pain that all of these tools that you're talking about with the DNR, etc., are really trying to help.
Right.
And make everybody comfortable on all ends. And I think that's the ultimate good that is trying to happen here. Is to help people have the freedoms and get what they want when they can say what they want.
One thing, too, some of the stuff I've read is that, you know, at the end, the doctors will keep doing all these procedures, and it actually shortens the patient's life. If they get into hospice care, they have a possibility of living longer. I know a friend of mine whose husband, he was in a wheelchair, he had oxygen, I think he had diabetes, and he, I think in his mid-70s or so, went to the dentist and had some dental work done and got the MRSA infection.
Oh,
I think that's what it's called. And so, you know, the doctor said, you know, it's mandatory that we operate. So this whole thing started, you know, like he's in a weakened condition to begin with. And so they're doing this surgery, and then he needs another, I think he had like 3, 4, 5 surgeries, like a very short time, and he died 8-10 months later. I mean, this is terrible. And, you know, actors would even do that.
That's a lot to go through.
Yeah. And, you know, and each time, you know, like if you're in the hospital for more than a few days, and this happens to young people, but it, as you get older, it happens more and more, is you lose mental capacity. You know, like if you're in the hospital a lot, your ability to be able to think clearly, to reason is compromised. it can be greatly compromised.
Interesting.
It's not all the time, but it happens a lot. I read some, I can't remember what the statistic was, but the number, but I think it was like 70,000 patients in Minnesota per year. I took whatever the grand number was. I think it was 14 million and divided it by 50, you know, like assuming each state had the same number.
Oh, got it.
Okay. So, and it was something like 70,000 or 700,000 people per year end up with cognitive deficits from just being in a hospital.
Wow.
Yeah.
I suppose the lack of stimulation, the same four walls, the...
It's actually more the waking you up at 10 o'clock to take blood and waking you up at 11:30 to get your blood pressure and taking you up at midnight to get an EKG and taking you... I read somewhere that the hospitals, this blew my mind, that with little children, they were going to stop giving them baths at 3 or 4 in the morning because that's when it's convenient for the nurses to do it so that they can get more sleep. It's the lack of sleep and then the constant beeping and noises and, you know, we need to draw more blood. We need to do this. We need to do that. And it goes on all night long.
That makes a lot of sense. We know how important sleep is.
Yeah.
I know that's the joke that kind of always comes up with hospital. I had somebody recently in the hospital was saying, well, wouldn't have been so bad if I wouldn't have, you know, been woken up every hour and a half. Just leave me alone. I was sleeping.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty valid point. And we're not looking at our own science and research to say, no, sleep is really important. How do we do this?
Right.
And I understand the nurse's perspectives, too. There is a point to that, but it's night, and then we can do this. But that's not looking at people's wellness and health in the best way possible.
Right, yeah. You know, well, we need to get a troponin level every 4 hours, and by God, it's time for that troponin level. Draw
them. Wow. That's a really interesting point. Anything else that you want to say that we haven't covered or any thoughts that you have?
I forgot to mention something, mm-hmm. or I don't think I mentioned it, about healthcare directives.
Yes.
Because we are on the border between Minnesota and Wisconsin. The Wisconsin healthcare directives are accepted in Minnesota, but the Minnesota ones are not accepted in Wisconsin. And the reason for that is because, first of all, in Minnesota, to make an advanced care directive legal or in place, it either needs to be signed by two people or your signature needs to be notarized. And in Wisconsin, they will only accept it if it's signed by two people. And it's not just witnessing the signing, but those two people are also testifying or whatever that the person who is doing this is of sound mind. Depending on where they get their care or whatever, they need to be aware that each state has its own laws, not only about advanced care directives, but also PULS. But that's a big one that can come up that people should be aware of.
Yeah, that's really important. If you're somewhere else,
yeah,
that could really affect your care. Wow. Boy, that's how do we all get on the same page with that in our country?
Well, advanced care directives are a fairly new instrument. You know, there's still conflict and concerns about even having that, you know, in place. So
right.
It's just, you know, one little more step moving forward. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are. And, you know, I realized my current healthcare directive is signed by a notary, but, you know, unless I have an accident, but then I also have a pulse. So, but that is transferable across.
Ah, okay.
I am quite sure, I think. But the advanced care directive is not necessarily unless you have the two signatures.
Okay.
Wow. But the Wisconsin one is legal in Minnesota, but the Minnesota one is not legal in Wisconsin.
So if you have the two signatures, would it be accepted? Or is it just, it doesn't matter, it's from Minnesota, we're not accepting it?
It's if you have the two signatures,
okay.
It would be. But if you have
the
notary one, it would not.
Okay. Oh, so we just need to have everybody sign our healthcare directive.
But they have to do it while it's being witnessed. So you'd have to have, you know, like take the two people with you to the notary to have everybody sign it.
Gotcha. Well, that's an interesting solution.
Yeah.
Kind of cover all bases there. Good to know. That's important. Well, thank you. This has been really great.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for talking with me.
A huge thank you again to Beth for sharing her experience and perspectives. And definitely giving us a few things to think about. Thank you for joining and sharing in our conversation. The books and games that are mentioned are going to be in the show notes, the names as well as links as I can procure them. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/wellnessren. And of course, iTunes. You can find our podcast under Wellness Renaissance Podcast. Thanks again. Look forward to having you join us next time. Have a wonderful day.